Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina. I'm in studio with my friend in New Mexico. And of course, the one and only Mr. Richard Polinelli in the background of Chicago at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And it's cold out here.
I am almost certain that's in front of your green screen.
It's windy where I am.
We have a brand new writer guest tonight that she will be joining us about quarter after six Pacific time. But right now, I want to mention and introduce a friend of mine from, 42 years back, Mr. Doug Deems, an accomplished musician and guy who's made more money on three chords than anyone else I've ever met in my life. Hello, Doug.
Thank you very much, Jim. Hey, it's good to be talking to you, my friend.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And Doug is a special guest tonight because the man who wrote the piece of music that opens our show, Mr. Rick Gilman, that piece was known as Buffalo Grass, and we used two pieces. One is Buffalo Grass, passed away yesterday. He was just shy of his 69th birthday. Doug and I knew him very well back in Tacoma, Washington, when we all played together at this little venue on North 6th and Pine, 610 North Pine Street, called the Engine House Number 9. Doug, you want to give us a few little memories about the E9?
Well, we all met, like you say, at the Engine House, and at the time that was pretty interesting because it was a fire station from the early 1900s, right, that had been made a national historical site. So all of a sudden they needed to figure out what to do with this facility. And the first turnaround with it was singer-songwriters, and they appealed to the music community.
Right.
And it was probably the first place I went, everything where we're all part of a workshop kind of thing.
Right.
Everybody was working on something. So it was,
right,
was interesting. And kind of at the head of the pack, if you will, was Rick Gilman. I mean, he was very intricate, very talented technical guitar player. He had the hot seat around Tacoma through the late 70s and into the mid 80s before darts and Pong and everything took over. But he was Mama Lemoyne's in the Tacoma Courthouse, was a really hot club at the time.
Right.
And he was there three weekends a month. The other weekend, he'd be at any number of venues that would pack. And he was really a remarkable player. And he did his workshopping at Engine House Number 9.
He did.
And that's how we got acquainted.
He did. In fact, there was one night that we were doing a show. My case was third, possibly you or someone. And
I opened my showcases there.
Yeah. I opened my showcase. They were always on Thursdays. I opened my showcase by saying, my mother always told me three things in life. Number one, never turn down food. Number two, never piss off a rat. And number three, never, ever, ever follow Rick Gilman.
Hey, fair enough. He certainly was going to set up the room.
He did set up the room. And, you know, he made it possible for all of us musicians to get better. And I think because of Rick, he taught me slide guitar. He made me a much better musician. We worked for hours and hours and hours, some nights and some afternoons, working on technique. And Rick showed me a lot of tricks on the 6 and 12 string guitar. And Rick played at the time almost exclusively 12 string guitar and did phenomenal. He shut a house down.
First time I saw him was an open mic at Engine House. Mm-hmm. I had heard his name because he was so popular around, but I had never really seen him. And all of a sudden they introduced Rick Gilman. He's in his second song, maybe, when I noticed that he's playing three songs on that guitar at the same time.
At the same time, right.
You know, he's got a melody, a bass line, and something else going. It just was phenomenal. And yeah. the first time we actually met was at a sheltered workshop. He worked in human services through the day, and I worked in human services. And I had just started a job down in Sumner, Washington. And Rick walks in, and he goes, "Doug Deems." And I looked at him, and I didn't recognize him. And I said, excuse me, who are you? And he looks at me, and he goes, "I'm Rick Gilman." And I said, "What?" Engine House number 9 that impressed me. I said, "One was Len Henry, and the other was you." And he thought that was the funniest thing. And from then on, then we became fast friends for,
yeah.
like
yeah.
you say, the last 40-plus years.
Yeah, Len Henry was a phenomenon at the Engine House. Len was he had been in a car accident and had lost a lot of his facilities. And
yeah, he had a traumatic brain injury. And
traumatic brain injury, right. Yeah. And they taught him how to play guitar. That was his therapy. And he used to get up on stage and do everything in one pitch, everything in one key, everything in one tempo.
Right on. He did.
And
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say there was about 6 of us that used to jump up on and harmonize with him. We were known as Len Henry's Eights.
Well, the thing was, all those colleagues, they would go to him and they thought they were making fun of him. But the deal was, he was digging it. He controlled that room, and everybody's singing bad, bad Leroy Brown in a 1, 2, 3, 4. And they think they're making fun of Len, and Len was just loving every second of it, man.
Right. And
so
it's the
Len
only
Henry
time,
and Rick Gilman.
It's the only time in your life that you'll ever hear bad Leroy Brown done in 4/4 time.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
The sad part, this takes us a little bit away from Rick, but it's a Rick story. The sad part is, several years after the Engine House number 9 period and those things, Rick's walking down through Tacoma, and Len Henry and a social worker were walking down the street. And Rick goes, "Hey, Len, how you doing?" And Len recognizes, "Oh, Rick, how you doing?" And Rick starts in on, "Hey, how's the guitar playing and songs and stuff?" And the social worker pulls Rick away,
right,
and says, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't try and encourage that fantasy."
Right.
And I fucking went nuts, man. I couldn't believe that. If anybody ever tampers with my fantasy, I'll kill him.
Yeah.
You
know what I mean? I mean, Len Henry was as serious as any one of us and was looking forward to a successful rock and roll career.
Right.
Anyway, that's a Rick right. Gilman story.
Well, I mean, we can tell Rick Gilman stories all night, but suffice it to say, a true gentleman. Wonderful musician, and would virtually, and did, give you the shirt off his back. He gave me virtually the shirt off of his back once. And I told Bobby, I told you this. It was a black shirt with red roses embroidered on it. He was at my house in Gig Harbor, and he lived in Gig Harbor at the time with his wife Addie and his daughter Katie. He liked that shirt, Rick. And I was really kind of funning him because I didn't really like the shirt. It was a little too much for me, but he says, "You want here?" And he virtually took it off and handed it to me. Said, "Here, it's yours now." Wow.
Yeah.
So I hung in my closet for years. I couldn't tell you what happened to it after that, but that was the kind of guy Rick was. And he started a program out one of the taverns in Tacoma, downtown, or actually not up in the hill, called Back Porch Opportunities.
Yeah, at the Bavarian.
And my old band Sundown came up and played up there, yeah. and David Audie and I have singles used to go up there and play, and Doug, I know you had been up there and played, and Dan Washington was up there and played, and
Dan Washington and Burl E2 and all of us.
I know.
All the guys that hung out in Engine House moved over there.
Yeah, it was a place that all do Latin Victory music. We used to go take over on Monday nights or Thursday nights, whichever Victory music was, and take over their open mic nights. And when everybody knew that we were all coming down, they just packed the house. And it was so much fun.
Victory music was the big antagonist.
Right. They were the big anti-engine house.
They were folkies, right? They were folkies. They were dedicated to acoustic music, blah, 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 down the line.
Right.
And we would go over there. They would come. I remember when they came to one of the songwriting shows you were talking about.
They did. They
and
came
a lady
up, yeah.
named Catherine, lady named Catherine Batson.
Yes.
Sang when so-and-so was a gangly colt or something. I'll never forget that. Enough of the engine house guys, or enough of the antique sandwich shop guys, Victory Music, to win the votes, who was the best song. So she won that night.
Yeah, she won that night.
Broke my heart.
That was the man that was Rick Gilman. And like I said, he struggled with some stuff when he was younger, as did we all. But fortunately for Rick, and once we reconnected, it felt like 5 minutes that we were fast friends again. Called me about once every other week and just to see how I was doing and we talked about Doug a lot. Doug, you know, like Rick says, Doug did more with three chords than anyone else I ever met.
And he built a few songs, that's for sure.
Oh, for sure.
But
and, you
actually,
know,
the thing that I can disclose about Rick is if you listen to what he does and the intricate things he's doing,
mm-hmm.
when you read or three songs,
right.
several Rick Gilman songs in my own inimitable style, based on the fact that their basic progression is a three chord.
So, well, yeah, but
he was great at simplicity.
He did a lot of Travis Mickey and a lot of slide guitar. It makes everything sound really good. So,
yeah, but, no, absolutely.
A consummate songwriter. The man was constantly writing music. And kudos to Rick because when I called him and I said, Rick, I need an opening song for the writer's block. And he said, well, here, you know, he gave me a list of what he had. And pick one or two or three, whatever you want.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
That's and they're yours. You can have the copyrights. They belong to you now and use them and enjoy them. And Rick was also a big fan of the show. He never missed an episode after he gave us the music to open it by.
Yeah. Well, He said, I found Jim Christina. I think maybe through Facebook or something, but he said, I found Jim Christina. And that was a big deal, man, to be connected. So that was good.
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't realize how good of friends you were until you aren't, and then you are again.
Yeah, until all those years go by, man.
Yeah, and, you know, he loved my books, and, you know, he loved the show. He liked hearing his name, of course, you know.
But, hey, we're all a bunch of narcissists, man.
We are. You know what? There's not a musician that I know of that is not a narcissist.
Yeah, I don't even worry about that. Right.
So... But this is our tribute to Mr. Rick Gilman. If anybody have anything to add, like you two, you have anything you'd like to say about any of the music that you've heard that Rick's done?
Well, I've caught just a little bit of it from the two songs that we've had on the show. I've had a chance to hear, but I'm going to see if there's anything out there, if anybody's got any copies.
He's on CD Baby. He's on Spotify. He's all those places. Yep. I would Google Rick, R-I-C, Gilman, G-I-L-L-M-A-N.
Yeah, he's got a YouTube channel, too.
He's got a YouTube. You can certainly connect with Rick Gilman's material. He was about that.
Yeah. And his son, he does a lot with his son.
Yeah, he did a lot with Bentley.
And, you know, his daughter, of course, I just got a message from her. And I had sent her a message on Facebook saying, told her that, you know, he had been a good friend for 42 years. And I was really, really, really sorry. And my heart goes out to you and your family. And she wrote me back a very nice note. She says, you know, she says, I don't remember you because I was too young, but I do know my dad talked about you. That was Casey. So. Anyway, I'm going to let you go, Doug, and thanks you for coming in.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
For reminiscing with us.
And everybody have a good evening, and I'm going to listen to the show.
And, of course, we're gonna stay in touch. So, as Hugh Downs used to say, we're in touch. You be in touch.
And
everybody, this has been Doug Deems, our old friend from Tacoma, Washington, calling in. And thank you again, Doug, for taking the time to be with us.
All right, great. Have a good evening, guys. Thank you.
You too, guys. Bye. You too. Bye-bye. We're going to go ahead and get to our first commercial, and then we're going to come right back to our guest. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block, and you'll be right back after this very brief word from LA Talk Radio. If you have never listened to LA Talk Radio, then you need to treat yourself to one of the best online live radio journalists. Found yourself saying, I can do that better? Well, then, LA Talk Radio wants you. See, we have 50-minute slots available all day, Saturdays and Sundays included. And we're looking to fill those slots with high-quality broadcasts from talk hosts that are in the know. If you think you have what it takes, go to www.latalkradio.com and click the link that says Become a Host. Then just follow the simple instructions. Before you know it, you'll be joining the legion of radio folks that got their start right here at LA Talk Radio. That's www.latalkradio.com. You have something to say. Now let's hear it. LA Talk Radio.
And we are back. It is now 6:15 Pacific time. And, of course, we now have a guest in our studio. She is a new writer. She's a mom. She's a mom. The woman does everything, or a little bit of everything. And she's poo-pooing me at this moment. But we have her actually with us tonight live from Florida. Please welcome to the Writer's Block in her very first appearance, and congratulations on your very first book, Catalyst, Ms. Nicole Fanning. Nicole, welcome to the Writer's Block.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, you're very welcome. I apologize for taking up the first 15 minutes of your time, but it was important to us.
No, that's perfect. That was a beautiful tribute to you.
Well, thank you. And so your new book, Catalyst, you have two of them out now. Your first book was Catalyst, and it's wow. I love mob books. I just do. It's in my blood. Well, mobsters are in my blood, so I suppose, I gotta like them somehow. I definitely like your story. I like the twists and turns that it takes, but I really like Jackson. Jackson's kind of a cool guy. For being a mobster and owning all these hotels, the guy's kind of cool.
He's definitely, it's always fascinating as, someone like thriller romance to think about what these people would be like in real life, like a single gorgeous billionaire, like hotel owner. Like, of course he's single, right? Like he wouldn't be with anybody. Definitely not. Like, so there's a little bit of unrealistic there, but yeah, he's a pretty cool guy for the most part. He's a very busy guy. That's for sure.
Yeah, he is. I have a real quick mafia story for you. And this is a true story. When I was 7 years old, my family went to the Philippines for 4 years. And my grandfather lived in East LA up on Clifton Street, overlooking the city. I was down in his music room. He used to have a music room downstairs in his house. His house was very small. And there was a piano down there. He was down there pounding on the piano one day, and he was getting mad at me because he was listening to his hi-fi at the time. There was no stereo. It was hi-fi. And there was this – he had spring doors on the front of his house, garden doors, all glass. And there's some guys showed up there, and there's two guys. One was real short, one guy's kind of tall. And they knock on the door, and my grandpa lets them in. And the first thing my grandfather says is, Jimmy, he says, stop the piano and go upstairs. And this little guy comes over to me, and he says, what is your name? I said, Jimmy. He says, hey, that's my name too.
And he your best friend.
So he says, hey. He says, you listen to your no-no. He says, you go upstairs. And I said, I saw the man on TV. It was Jimmy Fradiano, who at the time was the head of the mafia in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
And he was a really nice kid. He was nice to a seven-year-old kid. I'm sure he didn't shoot my grandpa, so he's probably a pretty nice man.
It was something that I kind of discovered when I was writing the book, was I wanted not just like stories of people who had come in contact with the mafia, because obviously those are, they're going to have a very one-sided perspective.
Sure.
You're probably not the most positive experience. But the stories that I started reading of like either first person accounts, people who had been in the mafia, had gotten out, or, you know, had dated someone in the mafia or had a relative or some kind of connection that way. It was very interesting because a lot of them told a different story of, you know, like that they were really nice people that, you know, looked out for their family, like loyalty and honor just to the family, not right. necessarily to the government or the powers
right.
that be.
Or to other mobsters.
That's kind of like the mafia across the globe, not, you know, just Sicilian or anything like that.
Exactly. Too. So why don't you take a minute or so and tell us about this book?
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind.
Absolutely. Okay, so Catalyst is the first book in the Heart of the Inferno series. There's going to be four books total. And it is a mafia thriller romance. And it tells the story of Jackson Pace, who is our undercover mafia don and billionaire hotelier. So he owns this luxury line of hotels across the globe. And then we have our heroine, who is Natalie, and she is a critical care nurse, and she actually ends up in Chicago, which is, you know, sound, Aiden's wedding, and it's a kind of an uncomfortable situation because she used to have this really close relationship with her family, but her ex-fiance, who just happens to be the best man and her cousin's best friend, ended up cheating on her. And so she broke things off with him, but out of respect to his relationship to her family, like couldn't bear to tell the family what had happened. So she just kind of removed herself and the family just didn't understand. So she's here for this wedding. She's trying to navigate this, you know, weird situation that she's in. And she ends up stopping a kidnapping attempt of Jackson's 6-year-old daughter. And in that, she puts herself in his path. And Jackson, obviously coming from a world that, you know, is very give and take, doesn't understand why this strange woman would just do something to him. Is she from another family? You know, like, does she want something from me? He doesn't understand the concept of she just saw this happening, realized that it was, you know, something that was bad, and she stepped in and did what she could. And in the process, they kind of collide. And it's just the story of their romance and everything that's happening around them. And yeah, hopefully that was quick enough for you.
yeah, that was. Bobby, do you remember what we talked about yesterday?
Yes. Should I just get it? Well, let me just tell you that although this is a fairly hefty book, you can't put it down and the pages turn really quickly. And I found the characters and the situations that they're in really engaging. I did have to suspend belief a little bit as a reader. I was like, you know, and car dealerships, and he has this massive shipping business, and we learn how much of it is legitimate and how much of it isn't. And he's still a young guy at 34, and you kind of go like, really?
Right.
But he is quite a complex man. And you write this book in actually three different people in first person. And I didn't, well, the oh, very...
You're right.
See, because I happen to go back to the first three or four pages, and it is a fairly lengthy book. And I was so glad I went back and read like the first five pages, because there's some really, it's not spoiler alert, it's in the first five pages, but I had missed it for some reason. And I thought, oh my goodness, we have another first person narrative. So what Jim was mentioning to me yesterday, as we go back over almost seven years of interviews, is we actually don't believe we've had an author who has been female writing a male character in first person.
Oh wow.
I've been racking my brain, Jim, kind of going back through some. There was a great book about Napoleon, and I was thinking, that Napoleon book, I think Napoleon. But in any case, Tell us a little bit about why you chose your main characters to tell us their story in first person, and then maybe was that challenging for you, especially the steamy scenes? Oh my gosh, yeah. Who knew Chicago could be so hot?
Woo! That's great. I'm so
Richard
excited.
Did. He's in front of it.
No, it's cold on this side of the lake.
In the first person perspective was that I felt like it would move the story along. And because the characters are so complex, it would give us those different perspectives and also, you know, change things up a bit. Like, just in the case of, you know, if you are someone who enjoys more of the thriller piece of the book, you know, Jackson's chapters will probably appeal to you more just based on what, you know, his job is, what he's doing, that kind of thing. If you're someone who's more into the romance side of things, Natalie's chapters will probably appeal to you as well. But it just gives like the reader a break throughout the book. But then it also allows us to see into like their mind, their thought process, you know, how they are different. And then when they do end up getting together, we see that they don't kind of become this like blob personality. Mm-hmm. They kind of just expand each other's world. And that was kind of my, you know, it isn't that like you become them or they become you. It's kind of like the Grinch, where like your heart grows three sizes and your world just gets bigger. And so I thought that being able to show how different they were would show how incredible their love story actually was. And, you know, that Jackson was a broken man. You know, he's a widower. He lost Rachel and he's got this daughter and, you know, he's trying to be a bad man who keeps worse men in check, as he says. And, you know, Natalie is healing from what happened with her family, but also kind of feeling ostracized from her own family because she can't stand up for herself and tell them what happened, you know. And so they're both damaged in different ways. And so I think that their different perspectives show that healing, you know, that kind of fusion that starts happening between them. Was it hardly, actually? It was actually harder to write Natalie's sometimes. And I find this really funny, but like I relate to Jackson more than I relate to Natalie. But I did have some help. My husband read and listened to me read all of Jackson's chapters to make sure that they passed the litmus test. So and there were times that he'd be like, yeah, he wouldn't think like that. That's not what he'd be thinking. That, you know, he'd definitely be thinking about something else in this scenario. Wink, wink, wink. So he kind of redirected it and helped put the perspective back. But it was a little bit difficult switching sometimes, like because it alternates every other chapter. So what I would do is I would write like maybe like 2, 4, 6. And I'd be in that like Jackson, like I'm a man mindset. And then I could switch. Now I could do the like soft.
She's a tough cookie. I mean, there is a softer side, but she's from the get go in the garage scene. She sees herself as kind of a soft. And yet every time she has an engagement that is life threatening, she steps up without fear. She runs forward. So it's interesting her perception of herself, because we get in her head, versus her actions. And I really liked Ethan, because Jackson is a man of small words. With Natalie, he does begin to speak better. But Ethan is, there's a quote early on where he says to him, "What did you say? Women are different, Jackson. They are all about the words. You have to be careful to use the right ones." And I thought, how interesting. Here's Jenny. He's 34 across the globe, and he's learning how important words are.
Yep.
Or at least how to talk to women.
Yeah, but I really liked Ethan's character and felt that he was important to Jackson's development of Jackson's character as well.
Without giving too much away, is essential to Jackson and his character development. And you know, that line always cracked me up, because I feel like that's a story, like even my husband said to me, like, "I don't know what I said that upset you." And it's like, I can tell you exactly what you said that upset me. And he's like, well, I didn't mean it like that. But yeah, no, Natalie is, she sees herself, that's a great way to put it. She sees herself as being really soft and quiet, you know, not much. And on the flip side, like, she and Jax have this clarity, but like, they just jump in and do what's necessary. But that's actually something that they can connect on. If Natalie was any softer, if she wasn't that, you know, I'm going to step in and save Charlie, or I'm, you know, I'm going to stand up to this guy that I've never met who's chasing after this child. If she wasn't that person, it wouldn't have drawn her to Jackson.
Mm-hmm, to Jackson.
Yeah. So, but she, I love that you picked up on that. And her, you know, calmness under pressure is really just a tribute to, you know, all, I have nurses in my life and doctors in my family. And, you know, I had a aunt that was a critical care nurse, and she was a huge part of my life. And she was the most calm person under pressure. So just having that sensibility of being like, okay, yes, I can let my emotions flare up and take this on a wild ride, or, you know, I can just take a deep breath.
And with you, you are listening to LI Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. And we will be back with you right after this brief word from Tuscany Bay Books.
You say you've written the end on a book that makes Rowling's look like Jack and Jill went up the hill, that makes Tolkien's look like a trip to the store, and finishes a series better than George R.R. Martin? But you don't know how to get your book into the hands of readers? Well, look, before you throw that manuscript in the trash and set Warp 10 for Get Me the Hell Out of Here, go to TuscanyBayBooks.com, click on the Submissions tab, tell us all about your book, and we'll get back in touch with you, and we'll help you get that thing formatted, edited, get a great book cover for it, get it out there so that people can read it, and let you know how to market it, too, so that you can do the important thing right next to book. Go there today.
And we are back with our guest, Nicole Fanning, and it is now, oh, look at that, 6:31 on your AM radio, no, on Pacific time, and we're talking to Nicole about her book, and we, of course, are going to now try to get into a little bit of her process, because it had to have been something to be able to do, well, write it, edit it, proofread it, format it, and publish it yourself. Is there a reason you chose that route?
So I, just to clarify, I did not edit and format it myself.
I
have an editor and a formatter for that. And bless them, because those are not things that I am good at. My proofreader, mm-hmm. editor, and my formatter all handle things that I cannot do. I learned that I chose self-publishing because I was too impatient to wait. I was like, I wrote this book and everybody needs to read it. So that was kind of the decision-making process there. But I had learned a lot in the process, obviously. And, you know, part of that is just finding your team. So, you know, you can't do everything as much as you want to do everything. You are going to get lost trying to see the forest through the trees. So you need that proofreader, that editor, that ARC team, that formatter. You need those people to, you know, call you out on some stuff. So yeah, it was really important. And, you know, that without them, I wouldn't be where we're at today. So yeah.
Yeah. That's what Richard and I do. So I spend hours and hours and hours proofreading and editing and formatting.
Oh, bless you.
Oh, oi.
Story and like that whole like process, and I am very specific in how I wrote. But when I first published, when I first published, I actually just like read it a couple times and then submitted it to the world. And then when I started getting my first feedback, it was like, this should have been edited, and I was like, maybe I should hire an editor. And so I learned in that process, and so within like a couple months, I had hired the proofreader and the editor, and kind of gone from there. But, you know, it's all things you learn as a new author. So
It is. And, you know, the nice thing about it is that for every book afterwards, it gets better and better and better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And pretty soon your editor is going to be calling you and saying, I couldn't find anything.
Well, it has gotten better with each book. So that's been pretty good. We're on book 3 now. It's going to come out this summer. So pretty excited about that.
Excellent.
But I'm writing, God, literally any time of day. I can be on my phone. I have a notepad that I carry with me a lot of the time. I have a voice recorder. And I'm writing all the time. So what I did when I first decided to write the series was I actually mapped out the plot for all four books, for the entire thing before I ever wrote a word of Catalyst. And then I also sat down and I wrote 122 pages of character backstory on all of these characters that are in the book, because, you know, as you guys had said, like, I wanted them to have a very unique voice. I wanted them to have a very unique, like, unique purpose. You know, the fact that, you know, Jackson is kind of a think twice, talk once kind of person, that's in his character profile. And so when I mapped all that stuff out, what I did was I made what I call the plot skeleton. So each chapter has like the main event that happens in that chapter. And so that, again, like how we're moving the story along and making sure that we're hitting all those plot points that we need for it to be a good mystery suspense. And that also kind of gives me the flexibility for the characters to take a little bit of freedom and go where they want to go. But it allows me as the author to, you know, be driving down the road and perhaps, you know, I've written chapters 1 through 12, but I'm thinking about chapter 22. I can go in and I can go home and I can write chapter 22 because I know exactly what's supposed to happen in 22 based on the plot skeleton. So, and then, you know, obviously buffer it up with the other two chapters around it. But I write kind of all day long, except that nighttime tends to be quieter. I know you mentioned I'm a mom. I'm actually just a dog mom. I'm not a kid mom, but not of my own children. I have, you know, lots of nieces and nephews that I love. And just to be able to get like in the zone of my fictional little world that we've created here.
Okay, Rich?
Well, I was just, I mean, we pretty much covered everything I was going to bring up other than the fact I'm a little annoyed with you, Nicole. I've got a million things I've got to do, and now I got to go read the second book of this series.
Yay!
All right, seriously. No, I mean, it was really well done. It's odd we had Peggy Chambers on last week, and we were talking about when you write a series, she doesn't like to have it end, the individual book end in a cliffhanger. And then you do kind of have a cliffhanger at the end of this book, right. And I can't go into, but yep. You did it so well that as soon as I got done reading Catalyst, I'm thinking, there's a book too? All right, well, I know what I'm going to do when I get a hold of it. So it was really well done. And was that a decision made? Or?
No, it was an intentional decision. And I hate cliffhangers. You should see me if it's like my favorite TV show. I'll put off watching the whole series until the whole thing's done. Like, I didn't watch Friends until all of Friends was done because I don't like the suspense. I had to put in the cliffhangers. But I tried to make it so it was clear enough, you know, like we weren't left in absolute suspense what was going to happen. But I think the title in its kind of gives a little bit of a hint that something like that's going to happen. Because, you know, a catalyst is something that comes into the situation, affects the situation, right, and then leaves. And so it was something where we wanted to make sure that the readers were hooked and they were interested and invested, but also, you know, that they weren't coming for me and finding a van to live in outside my house until I was done. Not allow myself, you know, because I told you I had the plot skeleton for each book already mapped out, right? I did not allow myself to write a single word of another book until book one was done. But the day that I hit publish and I published book one, I was writing book two. And book two was actually done in half the time and was like almost a quarter bigger. So I didn't have a life. That's all I did was write.
Yeah. Welcome to the club. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that you liked it. I'll have to get you a copy signed of book two. So.
Well, I will gladly accept that.
Excellent. Well, you know, there's a way to write a segue into a second book. And there was a way not to write a segue into a second book. And you have mastered that.
Thank you.
So sweet. The segue very well. And I applaud you. It's not all writers can do that.
Yeah. And the other thing I forgot to mention is you did not give away who was the the person behind, what is it, the two-headed dragon?
I guessed it.
You did very good keeping us wondering who that was. I figured it out right about the time the reveal hit. So it's like, okay, perfect timing. That is hard to do when you're trying not to give away. Again, going back to last week, we knew within, what, the first two chapters?
Yeah.
Who the person was.
Yeah.
This book, I enjoyed the fact that I'm still trying to figure out, okay, who could it be? You know, I kind of eliminated Black because it's like, he just doesn't seem like it. So who could this be? And it was like, wait a minute, it's got to be. And next page, yep, that's her or him or whatever it was. Well, so, you know.
It actually is better than the other one. I just know the lady in bed was. And does she have a name? And she goes, well, yes, she does, but not until the third book.
Does
have a name. And she does make an appearance in book three, and she's actually a little bit important in book three. And something that like my favorite authors did was they did those little breadcrumbs. They did those little rabbit trails. I want to give the readers enough that, you know, if they're looking for it, they could find it. Or like, you know, the hope as an author is that it gets reread, right? Like you want people to read it more than once. And like my favorite books, when I would reread them, I would find things I missed the first time. So it felt, had that same feeling of like, oh, I missed this the first time. So yeah, there's lots of little stuff like that in there and lots of little clues dropped. So,
and yeah, the occasional red herring for people to go chase off and they're like,
oh my God, that's a dead end. Okay. Okay. The way we're right back. Listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block and we'll be right back with you right after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity. Okay. You've written a book. How are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. They aren't going to sell your book. They don't want to sell your book, but they will take your brand from the ground up so you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, in radio, podcast, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. So why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge, it's your work and it's your brand. Why trust one else? Creative Edge.
And we're back. It is now 6:43. And we are with our guest, Nicole Fanning. And we're going to go a couple more minutes on process and whatever you two jabronis want to talk about. And then we're going to get into the last segment of the show, which, of course, is readership. So anyone else have any more questions for Nicole?
Go ahead, Bobby. You look like you have one.
Well, there's a scene. I don't think it's a spoiler alert. There's a very interesting scene with a ship that has been missing that comes into a ship dockyard spot, and there was some things about subways. I wondered if you had to do, and you don't live in Chicago, this does take, that's why Richard and I have Chicago skylines up behind us. Was there some research that you had to do and go back and then nail down some specific action points?
I tried to do my research wherever possible. So I did look up, you know, whether Chicago had a subway system, you know, if they did have the ports, if they had things like that. Just because I knew that things like that, that are, you know, you say, well, they're using the subway system in Chicago, and somebody that lives in Chicago is like, we don't have a subway system, if they didn't. Like, it disconnects your reader. Kind of like the same when, it, for like the medical stuff, because Natalie's a nurse, and you know, especially in like book two, there's a lot more medical stuff that happens. That was all stuff where, you know, I'm texting my doctor friends, like, what would happen in this scenario? What would happen in this? You know, like if somebody's poisoned, like what would be the first thing you'd want to do? And just because, again, like I'm trying to give the reader reasons and ways to with the story, the vanilla side of the research, the other research, you know, regarding bullets and bomb making and all kinds of stuff probably has landed me on a government watch list my Google search history is like, how many bullets are in a clip and like things that I don't know. But yeah, so it's a lot of research went into it. And, you know, even about like the mafia and the different underground crime organizations around the world, whether that's like the cartel or the triads, you know, just trying to give a different picture that is both like accurate, but, you know, enough that you can have fun with it because it's fiction and that's what we're here for. So.
Yeah, I have an author friend who thinks he's on an NSA list so much that when he gets done with his research, his last Google search is, good night, NSA agent, and scooter off. So it's not Declan, but I mean, we all do it. We, with all the research we're doing, you know, how do you blow something up? How do you blow a plane out of the sky? And you're doing all this and you think, man, if somebody is monitoring this, I'm going to get the door kicked down here in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, I did a TikTok where I was like, yeah, I have done, you know, how many bullets are in a clip? How do you make a fertilizer bomb? What's the best way to dispose of a body? You know, how?
That'll get you caught.
And I'm like, I'm not a terrorist. I am a romance writer and I write mafia thrillers. So that's me. I promise I'm not. But yeah, no, it's definitely a lot of research went into it, and sometimes funny stuff that you don't even think that you would need to research. But one of them was like, how many stories can you have in a skyscraper? Because I know like Jackson has a penthouse on like the 44th floor, and just to make sure, like, you know, would somebody come for me and probably crucify me for it? No, but is it at least worth making a note about and being like, okay, well, let's not make it the 85th floor because, you know, then we're not in Chicago anymore.
No, because those buildings fell down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually 44 floors is actually only 43 floors.
Right.
Because there's no 13th floor.
No 13th floor.
Yep.
So, okay. The question is, have you ever had writer's block? If you have, how did you get over it? And if not, how did you avoid it? You have 1 minute to answer.
Okay, so I actually thankfully do not suffer from writer's block very often because I make a writing habit to write something every day. When I first started out as a writer and I was doing this, I saw this YouTuber who was doing like top things, new writers, no such thing as writer's block. There's just undisciplined writing. And like that was her opinion, but like that just kind of stuck with me that every day, whether I'm going in and rewriting what I wrote the day before, or I'm just doing a little bit, or I'm doing something, I'm still sitting down every day at some point in the day and doing some sort of writing. And I will be like, there's been times that I feel like I have writer's block. And then if I just sit down and start writing, it comes to you. It's shocking, but like, that's my go-to for like how to avoid it.
Well, that's Richard too. He doesn't think there's anything in writer's block, but then Richard lives in Colorado. No. So.
I said I never got it because with my newspaper career of 25
years,
that's
true.
I couldn't afford to have writer's block.
Right, right.
But I understand. Okay. I understand the concept. I just never have enjoyed it.
Now, you know, for all the world, Nicole, it looks like you're drinking out of a Jack Daniels bottle.
She better be. I'm disappointed.
Me too. Okay. When you're writing a book, are you writing? What do you expect from your readers? What do you want to give your readers as you're writing?
Obviously, I hope to give them a little bit of the escapism, you know, because we live in a crazy world of crazy times. And so being able to escape into a fictional world for a little while is great. But I also hope to, you know, there's subtle messages written throughout my works, you know, even with the mafia being what it is, and especially how like Jackson's mafia is set up. You know, where he's got this idea that everybody, like people aren't just black or white, you know, like when it comes to morality, they're, you know, shades of gray, and that there's a whole, you know, big chasm between those two where all of us exist. Like none of us are 100% good or 100% bad. And so there's little message around also, you know, that obviously, and to, you know, be able to heal from trauma and to just make better decisions as you move on. Like a big thing throughout the books is the theme of choices. You know, Jackson brings up over and over, like it's a choice. It's always a choice. You know, I made poor choices in the past, hopefully want to make better choices in the future. And then obviously them choosing each other despite all odds as well. So.
Okay. Alrighty. Well, you know what? We are out of time. We are totally, and so, and I'm sorry it went back so fast, and, you know, but we had to do our thing with Rick at the front, and it was our special thing for Rick Yeoman. So, thank you. Why don't you let our audience know where they can find you?
Absolutely. All right, you can find my books on Amazon and Kindle. If you're a Kindle Unlimited reader, they are free. And I'm Instagram. I have no idea what I'm doing on Twitter. So you can find me there too, but I don't post very often.
Okay. Thanks for allowing us to interrupt your evening, Nicole. It was great having you.
It was a pleasure.
Let Mickey know that we want you back on the show.
I would love to come back. Absolutely.
And we'll go through book two and book three next time. We'll make sure we have a little bit more time for you. Thanks again for leaving. Don't go away, because we're going to chat a little bit after the show. But it was great to have you with us. Next week we have a writer named Jody Hadlock, and her book The Lives of Diamond Bessie. I believe it's also her first novel, and she'll be with us next evening on the Writer's Block along with Henry Park, who will be joining us a week late, but he will be joining us. And Bobby Jean, tell Jim happy birthday from all of us.
Well,
and myself, and for Bobby Jean Bell, Jim Bell, Richard Polinelli, Sam Hassan, and for now Nicole Fanning, to my friend Doug Deems, who was nice enough to join us at the opening of the show, and for the bookie, without whom the show would not ever be possible. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.